Hi, and welcome to Brought to the Table. Today, we have another very, very special segment coming from the bottom of our hearts. It's really that, like, diseased part of our hearts that it's coming from, but it is the bottom. A subset of our normal cast, we have Diana Schulberg, Ian Walker, and myself, Scott Pruitt, being the host. This is a show where we normally have a large group of five friends come together and share things that they find fun, relevant, or otherwise interesting. Unfortunately, today we just have Diana and Ian doing their normal talk at lunch. Normally we have two groups. Today it's kind of just them rambling. I'm a freeloader. I'm going to be sitting here. I have noise-canceling headphones. Unfortunately, they don't cancel the noise that is coming through the audio jack, so I'll also be listening.
What if you put your noise-canceling headphones on your microphone?
Oh, shit. There it is.
This would be a strategy that I have not tried before, and I'm not going to do live on air.
that totally works. Like that just makes so much sense to me. That's that's how the words work in that sentence.
All right, we're gonna have trivia. Yes.
Oh, we do.
We are. Fun. We're gonna have to have trivia. Give me 1 second to repair. Actually,
I guess we can use trivia to see who
of
goes
course.
First.
Are we ready for trivia?
Yes.
Sure. Deja vu.
All right. A very relevant trivia question today. The plot of the hit 2010 movie Mothman occurred in which state? There West you go, Virginia. Ian. Your group gets to go first.
Hell yeah. Are you ready, Diana, my other competition slash group member?
Yeah, let's do this. Competing to be the best of friends.
All right. So actually, really quick, I want to try to remember... Scott, do you still have the thing for Mothman pulled up? Was it Point Pleasant or was it Gallipolis?
Point Pleasant.
It's Point Pleasant.
Can't confirm.
Yeah.
Okay. Because, like, I have family that lives really, like, they live in, like, Gallipolis and everything. And, like,
Scott, you made a mistake. Ian's family is all over the Virginia.
I mean, I have family in
all
West Virginia as well. Fight me.
Yeah, but in all the Virginias?
I mean, my parents live in the normal Virginia. Just like you guys.
So Normal. He does have family that lives in both of the Virginias. So, there you go. But yeah, and then, oh god, I can't think of the name of the bridge, but it was on the Ohio River, I think. The one that fell down, that Mothman was on.
Yep, 28 people died.
It's something like something Silver Bridge, or is it Steel Bridge? It was
I think Silver was something.
Something like that.
Anyway. So we're not actually talking about Mothman. We're talking about another fun kind of monster friend that you might have heard of. Cthulhu. Most people have heard of Cthulhu. Most people have seen him in reference. He is the kind of man, humanoid dude with the squid face and all them sweet, sweet tentacles that is definitely not Davy Jones. From the Pirates.
I don't know what you're talking about. I just see a normal dad in a suit.
Yep. Definitely Squid Boy. Yeah, we wanted to talk about Cthulhu today and the greater Lovecraft lore, so buckle on in for lore time with Ian and Diana.
We brought madness to the table.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, sorry, Scott. Sorry, not sorry. So, Cthulhu is part of a series of kind of short stories collection that belonged to the greater Cthulhu mythos, which was started by H.P. Lovecraft. H.P. Lovecraft was a horror writer, and he wrote originally The Call of Cthulhu, which is usually the story that most people kind of start with Lovecraft, a short story called The Call of Cthulhu in 1926. So he was writing, like, back in them days. He mostly wrote pulp fiction for magazines, and he didn't actually really become kind of big until after his death. He died like 45, 46, so relatively young. And after he died, his work really took off, and he really became an icon in horror fiction in general. And just about everybody kind of understands the Cthulhu, the Squid Man. And Call of Cthulhu is one of the very few stories where A, Cthulhu actually shows up, and B, the monsters from the Lovecraft mythos actually appear. So, Cthulhu, he's just your casual dude. He has a job, he has a family, he has tentacles, but you know what? A lot of, we've, In the hours of research that Ian and I have done, 90% of all Cthulhu monsters have tentacles of some kind.
I mean, in one way or another. Like, it is a repertoire of... I want to have, like, a big fancy word for tentacle arms, but, like, the best I can do is, like, sucker-ended appendages, and that just doesn't sound as good.
Yeah, which is ironic, considering a lot of Lovecraft's inspiration came from his own, like, fear of the ocean. And so, yeah, so a lot of his monsters, like Cthulhu with his kind of squid face, are modeled off of creatures in the ocean. And so Cthulhu actually fits into a much larger, really vast kind of mythos and lore that started with Lovecraft, because after Lovecraft died, a lot of people who, encouraged by Lovecraft, a lot of people kept picking up this lore and mythos, and they kept adding on, and they kept growing it. So today we're going to talk about how, we're going to talk about some of that mythos and lore, starting with our boy Cthulhu.
Yeah, so like Diana said... almost everything that Lovecraft really kind of came up with was built off of his own fears. Cthulhu and most of the great old ones, not like they originally came from places in outer space and like potentially Pluto, which was like a different planet. It was a planet at that time.
I double checked today. Pluto is still not officially classified as a planet. It is still a trans-Neptunian object.
Oh, wait, so they downgraded it from a planetoid or, like, dwarf planet?
I don't know the official term that it has now. I'm pretty sure trans-Neptunian object is a really general term, so I think that still applies. It is still defo not a planet.
All right, well, fun fact, we have now switched our topic from Cthulhu to the state of Pluto.
To the state of Pluto.
Ayo, girl, no. You heard about Pluto?
Get it?
That's messed up, right?
Anyways, like, Pluto was, like, where part of the Great Old Ones, which is what the race that Cthulhu is part of, are potentially from at one point or another, and then they came to, like, possibly Jupiter, and then later on into Earth. But for the most part, a lot of his mythos that Lovecraft came up with, a lot of it that people know with Cthulhu deals with the ocean and water and, like, the depths of... where we can't even, like, imagine what's down there.
Yeah.
And like Dana said, that's because, you know, Lovecraft was terrified of the deep. He was terrified of, like, the oceans.
And even today, there's still about 70%, 70-ish percent of the ocean that is unexplored, and we have no idea what's down there. So even years and years and years later... It's still a very viable fear, because there's 70% of our own planet that we have yet to explore.
So, Cthulhu?
Yeah.
Probably not. Maybe.
So, actually, one of the really cool things is one iconic part of Cthulhu that is brought up repeatedly as a theme in The Call of Cthulhu, the original story.
Do the reading.
Shoot. I'm sorry, Ian, you jinxed me. Do you remember the exact phrase?
Which one are you talking about? The one that's
in his house in Rillier, dead Cthulhu lays dreaming. Is that the exact phrase?
Fuck, that's the one that I don't actually have. Give me 2 seconds.
have a fun hot yeah. 2 seconds. Yeah?
That's about the gist of it, but okay, no, that's a different one that I'm looking at. Sorry, I thought you were going to try to do the actual, like, phrase for it.
I couldn't pronounce that. In the original what? Cthulhu myth, we can Ian and I can barely pronounce half of the names we're going to be talking to you about today.
Okay, so in his house at Rillieth, dead Cthulhu waits dreaming.
Yeah. So that phrase is interspersed repeatedly throughout the book, and it kind of sets up Cthulhu in his place in the world and kind of in the greater mythos of Lovecraft as kind of like an introduction. Cthulhu is a high priest of the Old Ones, and he lays in Rillieth. Rillieth? We're going to mispronounce things.
It's an alien language, so yeah. Like, pronounce it however you want.
He lays in Rillier, dreaming. And the idea is that he is in kind of this almost comatose state where he's not dead, he's not alive, he's not asleep, he's not awake. He lays there dreaming, waiting for kind of like the stars to align to awaken once more.
Which also, like, depends on what you read, because sometimes Cthulhu is, but then also sometimes Cthulhu is the one that's, like, responsible for watching over the other great old ones while they're actually sleeping like that. So, like, some stories has it to where he is sleeping and, like, dead like the other great old ones, and then others have it to where he's, like, in a lesser version of that where he can come to life sooner. It's weird.
Yeah. There's a lot of kind of, because Lovecraft never, not to, at least to my knowledge, he never sat down and wrote out like an itemized list of exactly who each person was and how they fit into the mythos. And there was actually some kind of changes he made in later rewrites. A lot of this can be a bit of conjecture because, like we said earlier, a lot of people have added on to this mythos. So Cthulhu, as we know him, is a high priest of the old ones. He lays in Rillier, which actually Lovecraft gave actual, like, Earth planet coordinates for where this sunken city was supposed to be located. Yeah, and actually something really funny. So during the Cold War, you know, the U.S. was doing a lot of kind of sonar oceanic work as a way of detecting for submarines and nuclear submissiles. And they had ended up finding this really weird, like Ian said, the best way you can describe it is like bloop out in like the ocean. And it was supposedly near the coordinates of where Rillier was. And to this day, they have yet to determine what this bloop was. All they can determine is that it wasn't mechanic. It was organic of some form, and it does not match anything we know today. And so it's really cool that that kind of adds to this mystery around this place, this city that's supposed to be in, like, the middle of the ocean where nothing should be, and a planet where we have yet to explore most of our oceans. And so Cthulhu is kind of waiting there, and he is the subject of a lot of supposed cults that are throughout the Lovecraft worlds. And they worship him in a way that they want to speak to him, want to prepare the world for when he awakens again. And they're ready to serve. And so the Call of Cthulhu really explores that. And it really focuses on Cthulhu, but like from other stories, you actually get this fun basis of where Cthulhu stands in the mythos, because as terrifying as Cthulhu is supposed to be, as powerful and as strong as he is nowhere near the top dog in this world, in this mythos. His great-great-grandfather, Azathoth, is actually the head of that.
Yeah, so real quick, I just want to add in that with the bloop, it was Noah that like detected it in 1997, and it was consistent with like the sounds of large marine mammals, although it was also consistent with the noises generated by ice quakes in large icebergs or large icebergs scraping the ocean floor. And in 2012, they came out and they said, yeah, it's definitely ice related. But like there is a very small difference between where the bloop was heard and detected and then, like, where the city of Relief was reported to be in Lovecraft stories. So the bloop was roughly triangulated to 50 south and 100 west. And then the Relief was, I want to say, 126 west by, like, 47 south. So, like, 47 south, 126 west. So, like, very much the same sort of area, like, off by, like, a few degrees. So the fact that it's there is just really just an interesting coincidence, hopefully.
Hopefully.
But, so, like Diana was saying about, you know, big great-grandfather Azazoth, he's mentioned in...
Great-great-grandfather.
Yeah, did I just say great-grandfather?
Yes.
Oh, great-great-grandfather, Azazoth. He's mentioned in a few books, more so the Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath, and Azazoth is essentially known as like the blind idiot god. How we'd mentioned earlier that the other great old ones were like sleeping, but also like dead or comatose. Azazoth is essentially not conscious, he's alive and living, but also non-sentient or non-sapient and non-conscious. Like, he's not aware of the world around it at all. Like, there is no awareness or reaction at all to any of the world around it.
And if you're, like, trying to picture what these guys look like, almost 80% of them are like a mass of like flesh and matter and tentacles and teeth and stuff. So just hold that picture in your head, and that just about describes a lot of different people here.
Imagine an amoeba made out of flesh with a bunch of eyes and teeth and tentacles.
Lots of tentacles.
Lots of tentacles.
So many tentacles.
Anyways, we're not even going to go down that track. So Azazoth is also potentially responsible for creating everything, maybe? Like, somehow his existence is the cause of everything. So, like, maybe everything that is in existence is part of his dream, and if he wakes up, everything dies? We're not really sure, but that's a rumor that, like, flows a couple of different stories that are in the Lovecraft mythos. There are also a couple of other outer gods, of which Azazoth is part of, but there are also a couple of other outer gods that are responsible for, like, playing flutes near him and basically making noise that somehow also keeps him asleep. So we're not really sure how to handle him. Basically, if he was to, like, become aware and, you know, conscious of the world around him, it would stop being alive. Like, the world would stop being, the universe would stop being, everything would stop being. So, don't wake Azazoth. I would love to see that as a board game for kids.
Don't wake, instead of Ring Around the Rosie, don't wake Azazoth.
Well, no, they had that game, Don't Wake Daddy. Like, you're a kid
who was
trying. Yeah, it was an old board game called Don't Wake Daddy, where, like, you were trying to move through, like, this fake house to, like, get to the kitchen to get a snack, and, like, if you did something wrong, it would wake up this, like, father, and then you lost.
When was this a board game? 1776?
No. They only had hoops and sticks back then.
You would know!
I would know. I was there. Anyways, yeah, that was a game. God, children. anyways, underneath Azazoth, there's a couple different entities underneath Azazoth. The first one that we'll talk about would be Yog-Sothoth. In case you can't know, or in case you can't realize, Lovecraft loved making up difficult names to say.
I'm convinced he just had, like, a dartboard and, like, a dictionary, and just, like, blindfolded, just went at it. It was like, these look like two good words, let's mush them together.
I'm still saying he had a bunch of Scrabble pieces and just threw them on the table and just went from there.
Fair, fair.
But, so, Yog-Sothoth. Anybody who has played any of the Elder Scrolls games and have had an encounter with the Daedric entity known as Hermaeus Mora, that is Yog-Sothoth, essentially. A quote from the Dunwich Horror, in which Yog-Sothoth kind of plays a larger role in the sense that he impregnates a human woman, and she has two children. Yeah, very weird. Anyways, Yog-Sothoth, the quote is, Yog-Sothoth knows the gate. Yog-Sothoth is the gate. Yog-Sothoth is the key and the guardian of the gate. Past, present, future, all are one in Yog-Sothoth. He knows where the old ones broke through of old and where they shall break through again. He knows where they have trod Earth's fields and where they still tread them, and why no one can behold them as they tread. So Yog-Sothoth is kind of like this entity that knows everything. If there's knowledge to be had, he knows it. And that's sort of his deal. In a lot of the stories that he plays a part in, it is because there is a individual that is trying to get this information that they can't find any other way. So they make a deal or interact with Yog-Sothoth, which is interesting because, like, he's Bard. Right? I always say he. There's really not genders that are, like, applicable to these things. So
yeah, Lovecraft only vaguely genders a handful of them, and even the one female entity that we've talked about has sometimes been referred to as male, even though mostly she's referred to as female. So when we say he or she, we're just kind of drawing on, like,
it's a large generally part thought of just, like, turn of phrase
and, yeah,
like, what has been done by, like, other people with these entities. So, like, yeah, Azazoth and Cthulhu, Yog-Sothoth, so far, like, they're all, like, vaguely male from the ways that they have been portrayed.
Yeah, they're male-coded in their writing.
So, this, like, in the original Lovecraftian stories, they're portrayed as male, but people have kind of built on top of this? Or is it, like, is it inconsistent in the same writing?
It's a little bit of both. It's kind of the idea that, like, these entities are, they're beyond our comprehension of, like, what they are. So in order to, like, in the original stories, they do have, like, the pronouns of, like, him or they or she. Like, they do have that. But there's also this idea that, like, they are so much above or beyond or outside of our comprehension that, like, the only way that we can make sense of it is to attach this gender code onto it. So, like, the thing is, like, Azazoth gave birth to Yog-Sothoth and Gnarly. Oh my god, I did it so well the other
You can
time.
Do it, Ian. You can do it.
Gnarly Mothotep. There we go.
Yeah.
Like, gave birth to those entities, but by itself. And then, like, Shub-Niggurath gave birth to Nug and Yeb, who Nug gives birth to Cthulhu. And, like, there's this idea that, like, they're outside of our understanding. So, like, us attaching these genders are the same thing as attaching morals to them. The things that they do are horrible, evil, destructive things in our view because they're bad for us. But, like, for these entities, they exist outside our realm of morality. So it's also, they exist outside of our realm of, like, understanding gender or biological sex.
Yeah, like, a good way of, like, also thinking about it is, like, crystal gem style. Like, gems in Steven Universe technically have, they call each other she, but it's not always, like, the same gender in the sense that we humans think of she. These are aliens, my dude.
Yeah. It's very much all up in the air.
So you're telling me that Cthulhu is just a light projection?
Yes.
I mean,
Scott figured it out. That was our punchline. Shoot. Episode over.
I mean, to be entirely fair, we're going to jump ahead for just a split second here. But, like, Cthulhu and the Great Old Ones are not made out of matter, like, flesh and blood, like we understand it. That is, like, they don't exist in the form of matter, or they aren't made up of the same sort of matter as humans or other entities are. So, like, that's one of the reasons why it's, like, Cthulhu lies dreaming in the city of Reliet. It's because if the circumstances aren't right, they can't exist in our universe because of the way that they're created. But if the circumstances are right,
if the stars align.
Yeah, if the stars are right, then they can exist.
I think that's an actual quote from Call of Cthulhu, too.
Yeah, it's,
it's pretty gosh darn close.
Yeah, so the line from, or the quote from Call of Cthulhu is, they were not comprised altogether of flesh and blood. They had shape, but that shape was not made of matter. When the stars were right, they could plunge from world to world through the sky. But when the stars were wrong, they could not live. But although they no longer lived, they would never really die. They all lay in stone houses in their great city of Reliet, preserved by the spells of mighty Cthulhu for a glorious resurrection when the stars and the earth might once be ready for them. Aren't the same thing we think of. So the light could be a thing.
So you're saying, like, It's kind of like some sci-fi bullshit where they're in another dimension made of extra-dimensional stuff, and only when things rotate together are we able to observe them in things we understand.
That's a pretty good way of putting it.
It's kind of the idea that they're made from stuff from another dimension, that it only whenever everything aligns correctly can they exist in this dimension. Because like even though they don't exist in this dimension, if the stars aren't right, they still have influence in the sense of being too close to things that they have made or have like an essence of them, or being too close to them even while they're not in this dimension can drive people to madness or anxiety or just give this like mutation sort of thing that alters the way that our physical forms, our mental abilities, our existence is.
Yeah, and actually one of the people we were going to talk about, okay, I got this. Nyarlathotep is actually one of these few beings who doesn't always have to wait for these stars to align and can still have a very real and physical effect on the world of humans and the world around him without needing the stars to align. And so when you were saying, so it's some sci-fi bullshit, the problem is that it's a doesn't apply to everyone, case-by-case kind of basis.
So that was one of the other things, is that Nyarlathotep is one of these outer gods, similar to Azathoth. He's not one of the great old ones. Nyarlathotep is actually the, and again, gender-coded here, but like, he is one of the sons of Azathoth. And
So quick pro tip. The great old ones are below the outer gods on our, like, pyramid here.
So at the very tip top of, like, if we're going to do, like, power structures, outer gods, great old ones, a bunch of other things. Like, that's how it goes.
So many other
things. That's kind of how it goes, specifically with, like, the Cthulhu line of entities. Because there's other entities and life forms outside of it, like the Elder Things, which if we might talk about those. But Nyarlathotep, in some stories, is also responsible for bringing the other outer gods into our existence. So, like, sometimes it's Cthulhu who's responsible for keeping the outer gods in their sleeping stasis form until everything is right for them. In other stories, Nyarlathotep is the one who is able to just pull them in or make things right for them and pull them into existence whenever he wants, but he, like, chooses not to. And nobody is really sure why, but a lot of the conjecture is the thought of, hey, I have a lot of fun with this planet as it is because I get to run around and, like, be a horrible, cruel, like, demon trickster. Like, imagine the stereotypical devil that, you know, the devil goes down to Georgia to make these deals and stuff like that. That is Nyarlathotep.
Yeah, and like in actual Lovecraft lore, Nyarlathotep is actually the basis for Christian Satan. Like in the world of Lovecraft, this is the boy that the Christians based Satan on.
And it's like his whole stick is basically, I have fun, like, tormenting and torturing and manipulating these mortal beings. Why would I want to bring in Azazoth, who's just gonna like fuck everything up and poof, everything's gone? Like, this is my playground, these are my toys, I'm not gonna invite anybody in to fuck up my toys.
Yeah, and he was actually one of the very few of these like massively powerful beings to ever really appear in a humanoid kind of form, in like a human face kind of deal, to the point where he's often described looking like an Egyptian pharaoh. And it's actually very interesting because Lovecraft, writing in the 1920s, based him off of a lot of these showmen's kind of like...
Tesla is one of them.
Yeah, like Tesla. Like these people who would go to these massive auditoriums and cause this like magic science chaos and look very ominous. That's actually who this boy, whose name I'm not going to keep saying because it is difficult to say, is supposed to be based on. Don't laugh, it's hard.
Like, all of them are difficult. Well, all right, Nyarlathotep is a difficult.
Shub-Niggurath is not that
hard. Shub-Niggurath isn't that bad of a name. But, no, like, and that's the thing, is the story, Nyarr Lothotep kind of deals with that, where in the story, Nyarr Lothotep goes around as this entity who's showing off all of these cool magic things and technology and gains a gathering and essentially turns the entire world into like this cult, a raving cult of people that just want to watch everything burn and just destroy it. And he's okay with that because it's not going to be forever that it's destroyed. He's just wrecked all these people's lives and everything. And that's fun to do. But like, he can do it again later on. So Nyarr Lothotep is not a cool guy to mess with.
Yeah, also the other thing about Lovecraft, there's a lot of cults. There's cults for every single one of these thousands of beings, and Ian and I are barely scratching the, not at all, forgive the pun, ice tip here, the tip of the iceberg. In our talking about, we're like hitting the big points. There's cults. There's so many cults devoted to like every single one of like these Lovecraftian monsters. And so if you were like, man, I like fish, we got a cult for that. Ah, man, I'm really down for chaos. We got a cult for that. You into light bulbs? We got a cult for that.
I mean, if you're into chaos, we've got like 30 cults. Like, we've listed off like a few of the great old ones and outer gods. I think we went through a list yesterday of like, what, 20-some just great old ones? There's so many of them. And those were ones that Lovecraft himself wrote out. So like, there were a few that were added in by other writers, but the majority of those were all just entities that Lovecraft listed as other great old ones. And it's just obscene how many of them there are. And I highly recommend taking a dive into this lore, but like, it is so easy to get lost in it because there's bits and pieces written about all of them here and there, and there's a mention of this guy there and a mention of her over there, but like, it's interesting just to see this world kind of expand.
So as we're talking about all these incredibly massively powerful and crazed, like, hardcore entities, you gotta be wondering, where do we humans, because we exist in the Lovecraft mythos, where do we come in?
Yeah, so humans are a fun sort of toy for a lot of these great old ones and elder beings and outer gods and all of these entities above and beyond what we can conceive of and understand. I think it was the second story that I read in the Lovecraft series or the Lovecraft mythos was At the Mountains of Madness, which is an amazing story about a scientific expedition to Antarctica. They find this like ruin of a city of entities called the Elder Things, and there is another set of entities other than the Great Old Ones. So like I said earlier on, there you have the Great Old Ones, and then you have all of these other things. The Elder Things are a race that lived on the planet Earth before the Great Old Ones showed up, and essentially were able to manipulate and create life in a bunch of different forms. So the line that I have from At the Mountains of Madness is, these vertebrates, as well as an infinity of other life forms, animal and vegetable, marine, terrestrial, and aerial, were the products of unguided evolution acting on life cells made by the Old Ones, but escaping beyond their radius of attention. They had been suffered to develop unchecked because they had not come in conflict with the dominant beings. Bothersome forms, of course, were mechanically exterminated. It interested us to see in some of the very last and most decadent sculptures of shambling primitive mammal, used sometimes for food and sometimes as an amusing buffoon by the land dwellers, whose vaguely simian and human foreshadowings were unmistakable. So what this is saying is that in the story At the Mountains of Madness, humankind were kind of like a petri dish experiment that somebody forgot, and it kind of did its own thing for thousands of years until they're like, oh, hey, where did that go? Oh, we accidentally made that? Oh, this is kind of cool. I wonder how it tastes. Oh, hey, it's kind of funny. We can toy around with this. So in the Lovecraft mythos, humans are kind of the result of the experimentations of these entities called the Elder Things. And yeah, they didn't kill us. Like, they could have, but they also had a bunch of wars with like some of the deep ones, which are another race that we're not going to get into because that would take way too long. But then they also had a bunch of wars with the great old ones, such as Cthulhu. And then there was another ice age that happened on Earth, and that also hurt the elder things. And so they eventually just died out, and we got lucky that they didn't really kill us off beforehand.
Yeah, and it's really interesting because humans in the Lovecraft mythos start as this bottom of the barrel, very kind of literally just completely randomly developed, like Ian was saying. And interestingly enough, once, like, when you kind of move things up to where the modern time in which Lovecraft was writing, humans are the primary way that the old gods who are sleeping, not sleeping, dead, not dead, are communicating through.
The great old ones.
Because there are also difference. Yeah, there's a difference between old ones and great old ones. I'm not exactly sure what it is, but there's a difference. Because in Call of Cthulhu, it initially starts and has its inciting action when a human is kind of forcibly come into contact with these great old ones through, like, the shaping of his mind, and it kind of goes from there, and that's how you introduce to the world. So humans, even though they, like, started as this accident that kind of just happened, they are now the primary way that these great old crazy entities communicate.
Yeah, so, like, what the fuck is even the point of being a human in these stories if everything is essentially above you but then wants to use you? Honestly, that's a lot of what Lovecraft really got into, is the idea that as humans we are in a very cold, uncaring, and vaguely terrifying universe. And so you exist for the simple purpose of existing, and there are so many things out there that you cannot even begin to understand. And that if you even manage to get, like, attempt to try and comprehend or understand these things, you're going to go crazy. And that's just how life is. So a lot of Lovecraft stories deal with the idea of this, like, dread and terror at the fact of, oh my God, we are not the biggest, baddest thing on this planet, let alone this universe, galaxy, solar system, anything. Like, there are so many things that we don't know. And that's why, like, a lot of Lovecraft pulled from the idea of fear of the unknown. So the quote that Lovecraft has about all of this is, the oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear. And the oldest and strongest kind of fear is the fear of the unknown. And that really sums up a lot of his writings, is the fact that there are a lot of things out there that we don't know. And there's a lot of things on this planet that we don't know. And some of those things, they're just here to play with us and, like, use us as toys.
Some of those things have squid faces.
Most of those things have tentacles.
Well, it made a lot of sense in the time that Lovecraft was writing, which was the 1920s, where things were kind of on a little bit of a downswing, in the sense that, like, you would still had some of the devastation from, you know, World War I. A lot of families had been utterly destroyed, and we hadn't quite gotten into World War II when there was a bigger boom in the economy. So this, like, sandwich spot that Lovecraft was writing in was often characterized by a lot of kind of sadder, depressinger themes that were happening in a lot of American literature. And so really, really walking it back around, our boy Lovecraft, he likes some tentacles, likes some cults, and he liked to explore the deep, dark, depressing bits of life that were happening all around him.
But he did not like the deep, dark ocean.
Nope, no ocean. Ocean bad.
But yeah, no, like, a lot of Lovecraft stuff is open for people to add to the canon. So, like, I would definitely, like, love to see if anybody who listens or knows of somebody who's written anything for Lovecraft, like, send it our way. I could guarantee you, I've probably seen worse, because Diana has linked me to some stuff that is, like, Cthulhu fanfiction.
Oh, man. Would you like to know what is in the Lovecraft? You know, want to know what is in the Lovecraft universe? A very brilliant book by a woman called Sarah Elliston, who is definitely not, who is definitely a real person, called Awoken.
Every sentence,
and everybody
every
should
word
read
in
it.
That sentence was a lie.
If you have ever wondered what would happen if Bella Swan fell in love with teenage Cthulhu, boy howdy, have I got a story for you. Awoken by Sarah Elliston. It is an utter
There's
delight.
There's also apparently an anime that deals with Nyarlathotep being like a teenage schoolgirl. And like,
she has silver hair, so it's okay.
It just is awful. But yeah, no, if you all want to have a good, fun, like, universe to write stories in that are going to be like big bad thing that we have no idea and is so much bigger and terrifying than us, check out Lovecraft.
Oh, okay, so Ian, favorite Lovecraft story?
Fuck. Honestly,
do you want me to go first?
Yeah, go.
So I love Call of Cthulhu because it really introduces you into this world. Understand that understand that Lovecraft's writing can be a little bulky to get through at times because of just his style and how he writes, but I think Call of Cthulhu is a really great introduction into the Cthulhu mythos. But also, if you get the chance, definitely read The Color from Space. If you've seen the movie Annihilation, this was actually kind of heavily influenced by this short story by Lovecraft. It's really creepy and really good.
Okay, so go ahead, Scott. We can switch out the order.
Oh, I mean, I was just going to say the book and movie from recent, Annihilation, are along the same theme of really weird shit. And I haven't read the book. I saw the movie and I thought it was really bad, but hearing this, and I heard somebody talk about the book and kind of how the book portrays this, I'm not going to spoil anything, but it's got like weird creatures, unknown things, and it's just kind of freaky. And the book kind of has like no resolution to it. It's just like shit is weird out there, from what I've been told. I just wanted to bring that up as a possible tangent to Lovecraftian lore.
I mean, yeah. That is a very big thing with like the Lovecraft Cthulhu books or stories, is that sometimes there isn't like any sort of conclusion. Things have happened, people have died, entire like settlements and houses and like existence is gone, and it's just, yep, that's a Thursday. So
yeah, just don't get attached to any main characters in these stories.
Most of them go insane. Honest, okay, so for my favorite book or my favorite story, oh, fuck. Like, honestly, the first one I read was Call of Cthulhu, just because, like, that's the one that I feel like a lot of people start with, so, like, it really has a good place for me. I highly recommend looking up any of these books as, like, audiobooks, so you can listen to them as you're going about your business, or just sitting down and reading them, because they're really good. So Call of Cthulhu, At the Mounds of Madness was also a very good one, and it was the one that really cemented for me of, oh, there's a bunch of lore here. I gotta get into this.
Ian and his lore. I gotta get on that.
I fucking love lore. Like, also, it's a good podcast. But then you have The Nameless City is another good one.
Oh, shoot. The Thing on the Doorstep, also good.
The Haunter in the Dark is a good one. The Color Out.
What's the Witch House one? The Witch House one is also really good.
Oh, fuck.
I can't remember the name of it, but it has Witch House in the title, and it incorporates Salem witch trial stuff, and that's real creepy, but very interesting all at the same time.
I know which one you're talking about, and that is a good one, because, like, I remember we talked about it, and it's like, how could you make the Salem witch trials more disturbing and more creepy? Give it to the Lovecraft. Let him do it. So Call of Cthulhu, At the Mounds of Madness, The Nameless City, Color Out of Space, The Curious Case of Dexter Ward, The Dunwich Girl.
A lot of these are also short stories, yeah. So if you're too intimidated by some of this to read a book, a lot of these are short stories that were published in pulp fiction magazines originally, and they were originally meant to be read as short, smaller, bite-sized pieces. So if you're, sometimes, like, if you're getting into something and you're intimidated by a big old book, like Lord of the Rings and the Silmarillion, like, this is your Hobbit here. This is, like, a nice, like, entry point.
Yeah, which is also, like, why I recommend finding an audiobook or, like, somebody reading it. Because sometimes that could be a little bit easier, because, like, I know that I've definitely gotten stuck rereading the same paragraph a handful of times, because I'm like, I don't understand half these words, because they're names of entities that are just... You just Google Cthulhu Great Old Ones and just read through some of those names. Just try. There's not enough vowels.
To be fair, we did that last night. It was a time.
There's just, oh my god. And then you also have some like Han.
Good old Han.
Yeb. Like, yeah.
Love it.
Yeah, those are definitely just the cool guys. But like, yeah. Honestly, there's a bunch of his stories that I really love. And I highly recommend all of them. Also, just be prepared for, like, a lot of stuff that's like, what the fuck? That doesn't sound right. Because, like, Lovecraft, as a person of his time, was rather racist. There's mentions of, everybody knows the Necronomicon. And its author is, if I remember correctly, described as the Mad Arab. And it's like, there's stuff like that. There's also descriptions of Nyarlathotep as like having a negroid face, and it's like, you know, like at the time that was acceptable, and like we've moved past that. We're not, you know, that is not.
Also, like, all women in these stories are like wives or sisters of some kind, or like very few of them are not attached in some way to a male character, so like, that doesn't make it okay, but just keep in mind you are reading something from the 1920s, and so it's okay to be like, maybe not the best life choices and ideas you could have had, but, like, this was also written in a time when these things were acceptable, and we should, you know, think on that and consider it, but don't let it, like, turn you off of the main plot bits.
Yeah. So, like, yeah, again, just keeping that in mind, Lovecraft was also just a very odd individual, because, like, I found out earlier today, actually, while I was just doing some quick, like, checking on stuff, he was anti-Semitic, but his wife was also Jewish. So, like...
Wait, what?
Yeah, like, I don't... Like, he was a very... like, I hate using this as a description for him, because, like, normally if it's, like, if somebody's racist and sexist, it's like, no, that isn't complicated. You're just a bad person. But he was a very complicated individual. Like... There was a lot of stuff, like, maybe there might be some issues that he needs to work out if he was still alive, but, like, yeah, I don't...
We'll get into death of the author and, like, author intent at a different time, because we both have so much thoughts on this.
So, yeah, I mean, that's all that I think we had, unless there's any questions?
No, I thought that was really interesting, especially when you got to the end and you described not just who the people were, but kind of like the general feel of the universe and how kind of these beings are just there doing their own thing and kind of not directly destroying our lives, but have the possibility to make them all terrible and we just can't do anything about it. Kind of, they make us helpless in the sense that we can only do as much as we can feasibly do and everything else is out of our comprehension.
It's literally the example of like, how ants would see us is how they see us. Like, we are essentially ants to them, or like we're bacteria or viruses or stuff like that. Like
amoebas. Like,
do we have like viruses and bacteria saying like, hey, you're horrible, horrible people for washing your hands. You're evil because you're killing us. We don't really consider that. We still do it, but we don't consider what that would be to them. That's very much what the Great Old Ones are to us. They're just sort of like doing their thing, and we don't like that, but they don't care.
All right. I think that's going to wrap it up. Thank you for tuning into our special spooky lore segment of the Brought to the Table podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and you're only a little bit confused and only a little bit dreading your existence in this terrible universe.
But if you have those thoughts, if you have other Cthulhu recommendations, corrections, any kind of thing, email us. Yes. Let us know. Ian and I would love to hear.
Call us out. I dare you.
Feel free to submit your own complaints or new ideas or calls for help to our email broughttothetable@gmail.com. If you just want to talk to us or find out more about the podcast, you can find us on Facebook, Tumblr, where our handle is Brought to the Table, or on Twitter, where our handle is @ToTheTablePod, because Twitter doesn't let you have handles that are too long. If you did like this segment, or you didn't, whatever, please leave a review on iTunes, on Stitcher, leave a note on Kevin, our carrier pigeon, if he's the one delivering you these episodes. Make sure you hit the subs.
He may have gone crazy from some of the writing of this. Don't worry about it.
He's now got tentacles instead of wings, so he's more of like a, you know...
carrier slug.
Carrier slug.
I was gonna go more like octopus, like water-based mail transit, but I like the slug idea.
Anyways, make sure you subscribe or give Kevin some money, whatever. Just don't miss any more episodes. Thank you for coming to our table today and any other times you came to our table before.
And have you seen the yellow sign?
Have you heard about our Lord and Savior?
Anyways, we're going to leave. Bye.
Don't tell Diana because I'm not supposed to be in this episode, but Hawaiian pizza.